It's the weekend, which means it's time for Jill on Money, the show that makes money fun and just happens to answer all your financial questions. Here's your host, Jill Schlesinger.
Welcome to hour number two of Jill on Money. We are delighted that you are with us. And we have a special treat this hour. We have a doctor, Mitu Storoni, University of Cambridge trained medical doctor. She's just written a new book, and it's such a good one because, like, at the beginning of the academic year, people always feel stress. So she has just written a book called Stress Proof, the Scientific Solution to Building a Resilient Brain and Life. Mitu Storoni, tell me a little bit about why you wrote this book. You are a doctor. You trained at Cambridge. You had this big career. Why write this book?
So I wrote this book because stress is a very... It's a word that's used very loosely and very commonly, and we're all affected by stress. But I came across a series of studies that shows that chronic stress isn't just some kind of abstract concept which we sweep under the carpet. Chronic stress physically changes the structure of the brain. So when I began writing it, there were lots of animal studies that showed this, that there was thinning in parts of the prefrontal cortex, the area I just mentioned, and the hippocampus when you put animals through chronic stress. And actually the first big study to show that this effect also happens in humans has only just been published out of the Karolinska Institute. So chronic stress physically shrinks parts of the human brain, but the beauty is it's reversible.
That's the part that was amazing to me, because I feel like sometimes we get into these cycles. And as you said, you know, stress comes in all forms, but sometimes the financial stuff comes to the forefront. It almost can mask other stress because it's so concrete. So we get stressed out about money. What happens in your brain when, let's say, the market goes down dramatically and I start to get worried? Tell me what's happening in my brain.
So of all the stresses in the world, the biggest stressor known to humans is that of uncertainty. There was a really fun study done where two groups of people were, well, they took a group of people, divided them into two. They told one half, you will now feel pain. And they heard a very sharp, shrill noise in their ears. They told the other half, you may or may not feel pain. There's a 50% chance you will feel pain. The stress response of the first group, who knew they would feel pain no matter what, was smaller than the stress response of the second group.
That's amazing. So just so I know I'm going to feel pain. I actually have a different reaction, a lesser reaction than the possibility of feeling pain.
Correct. So the uncertainty around the issue was more painful than pain itself.
So does that mean if I go to the doctor, I go to you and I go to your friend, you say to me, okay, you got to go to the doctor. And they say that moment where they're like, oh, we don't like how that mammogram looked. Let's go back in. So the moment that I have that uncertainty, I'm going to feel stressors. If they tell me bad news, yes, we found a lump. You have to have this. Is that a different stress in that moment? Or is that stress because it's knowable that I'm going to feel a little bit differently, or my brain's going to react differently?
So the stress response is different to uncertainty compared to the same situation that is certain. Mm. Now, admittedly, in the situation you described, you want to keep the hope there. Mm-hmm. But the uncertainty of it will still feel more stressful.
And it's amazing because if you think about being an investor or anything in your financial life is filled with uncertainty. And it's why I think people really tend to make really bad decisions so often, right? Because you have that stress and now you're prey to lots of different potential emotions that would make you react in a way that may not be in your best interest. So let's say that the market, you're worried about the market. It's going up, it's going down, but now it's going down. We're in the financial crisis and I'm stressed out about it. What can I do to relieve that stress?
So there have been so many studies carried out during the last financial crisis. And, just 2 weeks of more market volatility significantly increases the levels of cortisol. And they found this in a study on some traders at a bank in London. So market volatility makes a huge impact. So what can you do to relieve it? Well, there are several things you can do. So your priority should be to keep your mind under control. And the way you keep your mind under control is by keeping, so just taking a step back and looking at how the brain works. You have your higher executive brain, okay, who sits behind your forehead. And this executive brain assigns or decides which departments of your brain should come up, should their volumes should be raised, and which departments of the brain should, you know, take a back seat at every point during your day. When you are stressed, this coming back to decision making in a volatile market and volatile financial environment, this executive function is vital, because whenever you're making your decisions, whether you're watching the markets go down or go up, when you're making the decisions, you're weighing at least three things. You're weighing the potential for reward, you're weighing the potential for risk, and you're weighing your emotional baggage on that background. Mm. So these three things are being very carefully weighed. And if you imagine, if this were done, you know, in a legal setting, you would want your judge to be very calm, to notice all the arguments, to see the entire scenery. So when you are acutely stressed, your prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain that work with it, it loses this ability to make reasoned decisions, because it no longer surveys everything. It becomes reflexive. So it only acts in response to the threats it immediately sees, to the salient threats, and to things that at that moment increase their risk value or their reward value. So it does not survey the entire picture. Also, as you just said, your cortical control, so your prefrontal cortex, the way it controls the rest of the brain includes its control over your emotions. So when you're in a state of heightened alert, when there's uncertainty, you think you will be threatened, so you're in a state of alert, and at that moment, your emotions are dysregulated. So you react excessively, you have too much fear, or you have too much anticipation. And that changes the way you're making your decision. So in that situation, the best thing you can do is bring your prefrontal cortex under control. And I've got lots of tips in that book. But, you know, for instance, one of the ways you can do that is sensory decoupling. So you can momentarily detach yourself from your environment.
How do you do that?
So I describe several tips in there. One way is, first of all, you keep your attention anchored onto something else. And that something else has to be interesting enough and has to be big enough for you to completely detach your attention from your current, you know, your computer screen or your bills or whatever you have in front of you. So you just want your attention to detach, to uncouple from the situation that's causing you the emotional dysregulation. Do that for a few moments, or do that for as long as you can. Once you do that, you bring the rest of your brain under control, under your prefrontal control, and then you can go back to the task at hand. So if you're going through volatility, you do that repeatedly.
All right, we'll get back to the interview with Mitu Steroni. Stress-proof. Don't we all want to be stress-proof? You're listening to Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill. That's the number to call to have your financial questions answered. Back to Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. This is the program that takes the mystery out of your financial life. And one of the great mysteries is, why do our brains lead us astray? To find out why, that's why we have our special guest, Mitu Steroni. She's a doctor, and she's written a new book called Stress Proof, the Scientific Solution to Protect Your Brain and Body and Be More Resilient Every Day. So back to our interview right now with Mitu. We're going to talk about, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. I love in the book you say, you called something cognitive reappraisal. And I thought this was really interesting, because what it really means is, once you've disengaged, then you want to go back, right? And you write, cognitive reappraisal is when you take a second glance at your situation after you have disengaged your emotional brain. You re-examine the evidence rationally and pay attention to subtle features you may have missed before. So in that respect, you know, is that a place where you either, forgetting about subtle features, is it you reminding yourself that, look, I'm a long-term investor. This is happening. I don't have to do anything. There's no need for me to do you tell yourself those things? And if should you tell yourself those things, is that helpful?
It's very helpful. So the brain works in two modes, the short-term mode, the long-term mode, and it almost flips its status. So the long-term mode is goal-directed, and it's ignoring short-term risks, looking at long-term reward, and weighing short-term risks in terms of how it will affect long-term reward, not short-term reward. So when you're doing, when you have the mindset as a long-term investor, you want to pick up all the subtle cues around you. You want to not pay excessive attention to immediate risks. You want to analyze the whole situation as it stands with a long-term goal-directed point of view. When you are under chronic stress, so if you don't get a chance to get your cortex, your prefrontal control over the rest of your brain, you flip your status. Mm. You become about immediate things. It's all about what happens now. So immediate risks are magnified. They're amplified in your perception. You don't realize they are, but they are just in your head. And immediate rewards are distorted because they're weighed against these immediate risks. So your whole picture, and no matter how hard you try, your whole picture comes away from the long-term setting to the short-term setting, and you're threatened, your safety is threatened more by risk here and now than it would be in the long-term.
I remember when I was a financial advisor many years ago, we would give people these big written plans, right, printed out plans, and someone would said to me, I'm never going to look at this again. And I said, you know when you should look at it? When you're panicking, you're going to flip to this page, which reminds you that you're long, you know, you're in this for the long term. You have this many years. This is what you decided. It's almost like you have to remind yourself what is true. I mean, the truth is that yes, it's volatile here and it's happening in the short term, but it's almost like to kind of whack yourself in the head and say, wait a minute, this isn't everything, right? Can I just go back, just a question about you personally. Did you start exploring this topic? I mean, you're trained as a neurologist first, or
ophthalmologist first.
Ophthalmology. Okay. So ophthalmology first. You love eyes.
I love eyes.
You love them. They are the window of the soul. So eyes first. Then what is neuro-ophthalmology?
Neuro-ophthalmology is the part of the optic nerve and the part of the brain that deals with vision.
Okay. And then how did that translate into stress? Or did you become like a total stress bucket in your life and then thought stress is like something I want to explore?
So actually it's both. But one of the things that really fascinated me is the pupils in the eyes. And this has huge implications in the financial world as well, because when you're making a deal with someone or when you're exchanging trust, this plays a role. The pupils, our pupils are the little black apertures in the front of our eyes. And they are the only window that we have to the automatic or autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system is the network of nerves that work without us doing anything. So they keep us breathing. When we get stressed, they raise our heart rate. They're always at work, even when we're asleep. So your pupils tell you their net activity. So if you know someone really well, and even if you don't, if you're talking to someone, you synchronize your pupil sizes. Isn't that astonishing?
Wait a minute. That happens naturally? Like
that
right
happens
now?
Naturally.
So if Mark comes in here and looks at me, he's going to see our pupil sizes are similar right now.
Are similar. They will get drawn to, you know, a synchronized baseline.
Cool.
So your pupils don't just tell the other person about you and they give nonverbal signals about what you're doing, but they tell, you know, they show you how the autonomic nervous system works. And hence, they're a brilliant stress indicator. So they can tell you about the level of chronic stress. But obviously, it's relative to your own baseline. So it's a way of gauging it.
But if you were my doctor and you were talking to me and you were examining me and you were looking at my pupil size on a random day, you'd have a baseline of knowing what that was. And you could literally say to me when I walked in that day, oh, you seem to be under stress, because you would know that because I have a baseline. But I couldn't necessarily know that just meeting you now, right?
No, you couldn't.
Darn it. I thought that was going to be a good way for me to like go play poker next, but okay.
But the way the person's pupils respond to what you're saying when you're going through a negotiation or making, you know, some kind of discussion, that tells you a lot about what's taking place inside the person's mind.
Okay, what should we be looking for? I'm fascinated by
this. So, you know, look for, I mean, obviously everyone has their own variation,
right.
But you look for dilation, you look for, you know, it's things that you can't explain. And why did that person's pupils just dilate so much just now?
Oh.
And, you know, that sort of subtle, you know, subtle cue. That can tell you a little
point.
Bit. A deal point.
That's interesting. So what about the idea of this world that is now essentially, there's a lot of low level of human contact, not being able to look into someone's eyes. How is that changing what you perceive to be interaction, stress levels? I mean, in other words, if I'm stressed out by reading an email, I may not, the person could say the exact same thing and I'm looking into that person's eyes and I may not react the same way. So that almost tells me it's like a potential to read more stress into a situation than I need to. Is that possible?
It's entirely possible. And that works in two ways. So in one way, you can reduce the intensity of a negative message by putting it in print. But at the same time, when you put something in print, it can be misinterpreted very easily. And one thing with our technologically advanced world is it's made things very easy, and that prevents us from focusing. Because with multitasking and with, you know, quick solutions to things, we don't focus and work on things for very long. And coming back to what we said earlier, that is one way of training your goal-directed behavior, by working towards a problem, long-term solution. So it has lots of implications. Some are good and some are bad.
Okay, so you like get drawn to the eye, and the eye is this read on lots of different things in the brain. Were you a stressed out person in general? Like, what was your own experience around this?
I was probably the most stressed out person you can imagine.
No way. You're so calm, cool, and collected. I don't buy it. Mark, you reading her as stressed out? Not at all. No.
No, I said I was.
Okay. But what happened? So you were, because you were studying, or what was going on? Because it's just like a student life. I know it sounds crazy when we're not students, but it can be incredibly stressful.
It is. It's really medical residency and internship. That's what's very stressful. I think that the way I dealt with my stress and the way I realized that you can deal with stress is by coming back to prefrontal control, is by really training your mind for long-term goals and for self-control. Because in order to achieve a long-term goal, you have to have self-control. So, you know, coming back to the idea of investing as well, you only learn to ignore things in your immediate surrounding which are unnecessarily loud in your ears at that moment by training your self-control. And as you said, by reminding yourself of the goal, constantly reminding yourself of the goal. And when you're going through, you know, your medical training, you have a goal, and that goal is to specialize, to go through your board exams. But learning how to regulate yourself and learning how to change and switch your attention and get that under control makes a big difference.
All right, we'll get back with our interview with Mitu Steroni, MD, PhD, super smart. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL, send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
Jill on Money with Jill Schlesinger. Have a question? Call now, 855-411-JILL.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, an economic question, a tax question, an insurance question, give us a holler, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Are you wondering what will kick yourself into gear to get to that yoga class? Well, Our guest, Mitu Staroni, a doctor, is going to tell you why yoga may help you reduce your stress. So one of the things that you found was a physical outlet for that was really helpful for you because you found yoga, right? And so explain how that helps you in, or any of us, to do the practice of yoga or taking a walk or physical exercise, how that changes your brain and helps you kind of push some of those stress levels down or even just deal with your stress in a different way.
So ultimately, we should not look at stress as beginning below the brain. So it's not the brain starting the stress response. It's the brain interpreting the environment in a certain way and then triggering the stress response. And I'm talking about psychosocial stress, so not, you know, injury-related stress. So if you start from it at that level, then how you're perceiving the world depends on which departments in your brain are on high alert and which departments are asleep or less active. So if your emotional circuits are always on high alert, your experience of your world will be very different. So if you get good at controlling the rest of your brain, so you know, you can use the term self-regulation, you can use the term self-control, then your attention in your environment will be focused on the things that it should be focused on, so not things that are unnecessary or irrelevant. And the way yoga works is really by training your self-control. So if you are, you know, if you're, imagine the most uncomfortable posture if you've ever encountered in yoga, it doesn't have to be yoga. It can be anything else, but yoga is a great example. If you're holding yourself in that posture, you have 100 thoughts coming through your head. You think, this is uncomfortable. I want to get out of here. You're probably in some degree of pain because of the stretching, and you're really having to balance. All of that requires you to tell your emotional circuits to just be quiet, to activate your cortical circuits to control your attention, and to dampen down any pain or any discomfort that you're feeling. And with the brain, studies have shown that the more often you use this circuitry, the easier it becomes to use it. So if you practice this technique of self-control, in keeping yourself under control in discomfort repeatedly, time and time again, then you grow more in control of where you place your spotlight of attention. And you apply that when you leave your yoga studio or your home and you go to the rest of the world.
That's fascinating, though, because it also, well, for me, just in my own, like, I don't do yoga currently. I have done it. But it was one of the reasons I hated the whole flow yoga thing, because I felt like I was never in one pose long enough to do anything. And so so when I was doing yoga, what I really liked was Iyengar, you hold the pose. However, that moment where you're just in so much pain and your brain's blowing up, like, hello for me, pigeon, I hate that pose. And that, I almost remember feeling like this, where you're in it, you hate it, you hate it, you hate it, and then all of a sudden you're not feeling it in the same way. And so I guess that my question is, are you not feeling it, or, you know, you're telling your brain not to feel, like, what's happening there? What has just happened in that moment? Is it just that you're so uptight about being in that pose and that causes the stress and the pain, or is the pain, are you getting used to the pain?
So there are two things going on here. The first thing is that, you know, when you're in your pigeon pose, that you're safe. Okay. You can actually leave that pose whenever you want. So as soon as you know that, you relax a little bit, but you reassign, you achieve more control over your mind, over your brain. That gives you control. And through that control, you train yourself to ignore the feeling of panic, or to restrain the feeling of panic. And that gives you a testing ground for doing that. Because if you do that repeatedly in your yoga room, the next time you feel panic in another situation, you will remember the circuitry you used to calm that down. And another way that that works is that some of us are very aware of our interoceptive cues. So if our hearts start racing, for some people, we panic more. We think, oh my goodness, what's happening? But if you make your heart start racing in lots of contexts, in repeated contexts by doing yoga or whatever, then if it starts racing when you see your market slump the next morning, you are familiar with that. And you know what to do to bring yourself under control.
I see. So. Now, yoga as a practice is something that was supposed to be like, you do this to then begin your meditation. So is there a difference in your work or in the research that you've seen between the physical activity and the idea of meditation, or both useful in different ways?
So it's very hard for someone to sit still. And one of the things I mention in my book is, for instance, immediately after a stressful response, don't do nothing. Do something. And that's because it's very hard to tell your mind what to think. You can tell your mind what to do. Using that philosophy, yoga is a doing thing. So you're in a pose. Your arms are knotted up. So if you can do nothing else, all you can do is just try to do the action.
Mm-hmm.
That trains your mind. Once you get that under control, the next step, to sit still and just tell your mind what to think, becomes easier. And that's why meditation is the next step.
Oh, that's interesting. And there's obviously a bunch of research that does show that meditation can be very helpful in a practice setting, right? I was being so good for a while. I've really fallen off the rails. So, but what makes me think that one of the reasons that I was feeling like why I fell off the rails is that it started to become a stress in my life. Like, oh my God, I got to wake up at 4 because I have to be up at 4:30. So I got to do my meditation. I got to get up at 4 and do it then and da da da. And then what I found was something, I'm not going to make this all about me, but why not? It's my show. Then I found that I took my dogs on an afternoon walk and I was walking briskly. And then I stopped and I sat on a bench in the park with the dogs. And that was like a perfect moment just to be quiet. But it was harder for me to do that, even though everyone says, oh, do it first thing in the morning. I couldn't do it first thing. I couldn't sustain doing it first thing in the morning. Is that just my own clock, or is doing something physical before you try to do something more contemplative a better path?
So I would definitely say never sacrifice your sleep for anything.
We'll get back to our interview with Mitu Staroni, talking about how we can reduce your stress. You'll just be happier and probably more productive. It's Jill on Money, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back.
It's the weekend, and that can only mean one thing. You're listening to Jill on Money. Here she is, Jill Schlesinger.
You're back with Jill on Money. If you've got a financial question, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We are talking to author Mitu Staroni. She's written a book called Stress Proof. And one of the things that always is clear is that we have all been through rough times. What is the difference between those of us who are able to bounce back and those who are not able to bounce back? It has something to do with a single concept called elasticity. At the end of the book, you have a note about resilience. And I know there's been so much conversation around resilience and studies. You know, when you say resilience is the art of bouncing back, right? Everyone has stressful stuff that happens to them. But if you have an extraordinary event that's going on, how can you help yourself bounce back? Also, you know, giving short shrift to the idea that, look, you did go through something painful, right? You have to let yourself feel it. So I imagine that, you know, you've talked to psychiatrists about this, where, you know, there's part of it is like you want someone to be resilient, but you also want them to process it and go through it. So what's the balance there and how do you do that?
Obviously, I'm thinking a lot about what's happening in Texas, and it must be a horrific experience to go through at this moment. There have been a lot of studies from the earthquakes in Japan, on resilience and on what works and what doesn't work. And one thing that they found is, so emotional suppression is bad, okay? So if you're frustrated, let it out, because someone out there will share with you, okay? But what's really, really important when you go through these big episodes is the illusion of control. So whatever environment you're in, you need to focus on nothing else but being able to control elements of your environment. So, you know, making little changes. So clearly, if you're in the middle of the situation, you can't control anything. But even in that situation, control what you can. Okay, predict what you can. Minimize uncertainty. When you speak to people, don't leave unended sentences. Give people clarity. Operate in a system that's very, very clear and certain. There was a very sad episode of terrorism in Norway a little while ago, And they surveyed people who were working in the government buildings when a car blew up for terrorism. And these people, you know, this is in a workplace context, but they then returned to work after this terrorist incident. And they surveyed everyone around them to see what worked for them. How did they get their resilience back? And the people who suffered less psychological distress after the event were those who were in environments where everyone worked very hard to increase certainty, increase predictability, know what you're doing, who is around you, where you are doing it, the extent of whatever it is you're doing, what you're trying to achieve. So just creating certainty and predictability is the most powerful thing.
You know, you also make a note about writing things down and how that can be very helpful in doing that. And I am a person who, I love writing things down, but I was on TV, you know, literally the Monday after the hurricane hit. And I said to the anchor, you know, one thing that people can do is they can start literally making lists of what they think they lost. And the anchor looked at me like, you got to be kidding me. Like, you think someone's going to do that right now? But I think that maybe one of the reasons that I cling to things like that is that in my experience of seeing people go through bad things, when they wrote the things down that they had to do, it was that a little element of control. It was, you know, my father just died. Let me make a list of the people that I have to notify, or let me do this. And what is it about that writing down that is helpful? What's going on in my brain that's helping me in that moment?
So I'd say there are three things. The first is it's active coping, doing something active, writing a list, you're expending energy to do something about it. Number two is when you're writing something down, you're using parts of the brain that need you to be rational. So even for a moment, you're having to rationally think about what you're processing to create a coherent sentence. And in order to do that, you're having to ignore the emotional circus that's going on in your mind because you can't put that to paper. You're being factual. So that's the second thing. And I'd say that the third thing is, as you say, it's control. So it is, okay, you have something on your paper that is finite, it's solid, it's something you will work towards. No matter what is happening around you, you have that plan under your control.
I feel, first of all, I'm going to fire my shrink right now because I can just read this book. That this is what's better about this. Mitu Storoni, I'm going to say with an Italian accent. When do you slap yourself in the head sometimes saying like, oh, I'm letting my stress get away from me? What causes that for you?
What causes stress for me?
Yeah.
So really, every day, we all work in different ways. And we have different lifestyles, different priorities. And certain things affect some of us more than the other person, even if we're in the same environment. What's really interesting is you can live the same lifestyle from a day-to-day point of view. But if I personally don't do some of the things that I've mentioned in the book, some of the ways, so what I do first thing in the morning, what I do in the middle of the day, if I don't do those things for several days in a row, I feel it. So actually every day making a conscious decision to really take care of your brain and to make these little tiny hacks during your day, they make a huge difference that you can suddenly feel after a week. So if I go on vacation and I ignore these things, I feel terrible. So just investing, wake up in the morning and think you are the most important person in the world, which is true. Your brain is your most valuable tool, which is true. And everything else that happens is a consequence of that. So they should be your priority.
Well, thanks so much to Mitu Storoni, MD, PhD. Go grab her book, Stress Proof. So terrific. I learned a lot. If you want to keep learning, stay tuned. It's Jill on Money. Our phone number here, 855-411-JILL. Send us an email, askjill@jillonmoney.com. We'll be right back. You're back with Jill on Money. And before we close out the show, there was one topic I was unable to cover with Dr. Mitu Storoni, the author of Stress Proof. And that is something that I think we can all really benefit from. So the idea that, you know, you can really get in sync with somebody by looking into their eyes and your pupils turn the same size is totally freaking cool. However, here's something else. Think of it the converse of that. Me Too says, if you surround yourself with genuinely happy and positive people, you can catch their happiness. She says that mood is infectious, which I love, because this is another reason to remember that getting toxic people out of your life is a huge benefit to you in the long run. So here's the information, like the study behind it. There was a study that followed 4,000 people in a social network over 20 years and found that happiness can extend to up to 3 degrees of separation. If you are surrounded by happy people, you are more likely to be happy in the future. Now, the one thing is, of course, this is magnified by social media, but so is the opposite. So if there's someone who's bringing you down, if you can eliminate that person from your life, get them out. If you can't, let's say it's your boss, let's say it's a coworker, then you've got to figure out how to minimize your time with that person. And my theory about those like toxic, scary people is to kind of fake it and be like arbitrarily, incredibly happy around them. See if it makes a difference. See if your happiness will actually help that person a little bit. I used to work with somebody, I couldn't stand this person. Every time I see this person in the hall, I say, hello, so-and-so, how are you? And it's almost hysterical because this person can't help but saying back to me, oh, hi. Hi, Jill. Anyway, give it a shot. You have been listening to Jill on Money. 855-411-JILL. That's our phone number. Our email address, askjill@jillonmoney.com. Send us an email. Mark will flag it. Say hi to Mark. He is the best producer in the world. And stay tuned because next week we've got more of your questions. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you in a week.